Sobeuse.com. Rencontre par Marc Zisman.
Hello, Leonard Slatkin.
Hello, nice to be with you.
In France, in Lyon, your new hometown, let's say?
This is my second season, so I'm an old friend of the city.
Are you already familiar to the French cuisine and to the Lyon, la cuisine lyonnaise?
Well, if you look at my stomach, the answer is yes.
You have some favorites?
I have to be a little careful, but I must say the poulet à Bresse. And if you have it prepared properly, the quenelle is fantastic. I think here in Lyon, if you have 1-star Michelin, it's like a 3-star Michelin any place else.
So it's a good place for a conductor.
It would have been better if I had moved here before my heart attack. But now I have to be a little bit careful.
Yeah. So, like you said, I mean, it's going to be chapter 2 in a couple of days.
Yes.
So, what about chapter 1? How did it work? What do you think the good and the bad aspect of it?
It was a wonderful first season. The orchestra and me found ourselves working very well together. My method tends to be very efficient, very direct. I don't spend time talking about the philosophy of the music. I speak mostly about what we can do to make the sound as good as possible. And the orchestra appreciated that. They felt comfortable with this way of working. It's a wonderful orchestra, and really first class. They have their own sonority, their own special style, and I didn't want to change that. So what I try to bring is my own conception of a little bit of the sound that I like, but that was coupled with the very special sonority that they make. The strings, for example, now play a little bit more in the manner that I prefer, which is a rich sound, very full and very accommodating for their colleagues in the orchestra. But in the woodwinds, for instance, we have such wonderful soloists that I would be foolish to change their individuality. So it's a combination of the Lyon originality and with whatever I bring to the table.
It's like a first year, like a beginning of a love story. And
yes, you feel that there's a honeymoon, certainly. And we hope that the honeymoon never ends.
You think that a conductor has to be a good shrink, especially in the beginning?
Conductor has to be a good psychiatrist, a good mother, a good father, a good teacher, everything. A conductor is the person who must make the 100 musicians feel as one, but at the same time be sensitive to the individuals in the orchestra. And I've always felt that in my whole career of conducting. And here, you can feel the energy of the musicians. They really want to do a great job.
How did you build this chapter 2?
Well, chapter 2 starts with just a small piece of music, the Berlioz Requiem, which is only written for, in our case, about 450 musicians. The choruses come, one from the United States in Washington, another is coming from London with the Philharmonia Chorus, and the chorus from Lyon of Bernard Détu. We have the four brass bands, we have the 20 timpani, we have the six cymbals, the four tam-tams. So it's just a very small piece to start the season. But
was it essential for you that this piece has to be like the beginning of this season?
Yes, because it comes, we play it all in Côte Saint-André, which of course is where the big Berlioz Festival is and where Berlioz spent a great deal of his time. So it made the logical sense to begin with this piece. Last year we began the season with the Symphonie Fantastique. For me, it was not difficult because much of my conductor training was spent under the tutelage of a French conductor named Jean Morel. And those of us who were fortunate enough to study with him really learned the French sound and the French style. So for me, this is almost like playing American music.
So I guess even if you're not in love with all this second season, what are for you the key points of this second season?
Well, for me, we
in
have...
In terms of repertoire and in terms of where you want to bring the orchestra.
We have a... in the repertoire, there are a few very big pieces that will be the marking points of the year. We have a Mahler Third Symphony coming, which is always a big event. We present the two operas of Ravel, the L'Ora Espagnole and L'Enfant et le Sortilège. And this will be a production that we will take to Paris. So this will mark the first visit to Paris with me and the Orchestre National. There are really a lot of events with soloists that I can't wait to see again. Victoria Mulava comes, Emmanuel Ax is coming. At the end of the season, we have a festival with Jean-Yves Thibaudet where he's playing, I think, four different concertos, and we're doing some chamber music with him. And then all the works of Rachmaninoff for piano and orchestra with Olga Karin, who's become a favorite here in Lyon. So these are some of the things that I'm looking forward to. But really, I think when you talk about where the orchestra will be, what will be different in 1 year from now? And I'm hoping that our relationship becomes even more detailed and more focused. People might wonder, for instance, how do I actually communicate with the orchestra? I do speak French with them. I have what I would call repetition française, so I know what to say when I'm doing the work with them. And very rarely do I speak in English. It's interesting. And each year, I will try to get better. I do study a little bit, but it's not so easy at my age. I'm almost 68 years old. Learning new things is much more difficult than it used to be. But we found a way. And I'm hoping that with the language barrier non-existent, that the musicians and I will become closer in the way we evolve with the music, the sound we make. Even now, at the beginning of this second season, it's so fast the way the orchestra has adjusted to me. I didn't have to say much of anything. They played Berlioz, I conducted it, and we all knew what we were going to do together. Now it's a question of doing it with the great variety of repertoire that we'll be playing.
Thank you.
What did you learn as a conductor and as a musician from this first season and this new story?
It's interesting you use the word story and what I learned. I've written a book, which is in English. Perhaps it will be translated. It's called Conducting Business. And it's really about what you're asking. What does the conductor do? What do we learn as we go through our musical life? In the first year, I think I took my experience from all the years conducting and brought it here to Lyon. Obviously, when you're a young conductor and you don't have experience, you're learning. Now that I've traveled the world and conducted all the major orchestras and been music director in several cities, I can take that experience, both as a conductor and as an administrator, and bring it to the orchestra. So I think here, among the other things, I've learned to adjust to the French style of running an orchestra. It's different than in the United States, for example.
Yeah, that's something essential.
For example, in the States, we get very little money from the government. Hardly anything.
Fundraising.
And in fact, one of the two presidential candidates the other day said he was going to eliminate all the funds for the arts. Okay, I don't get into politics, but that's a problem we have. So my fundraising in the States is mostly private, works with corporations, with individuals, not with the government. Here in Lyon, I only do fundraising with the government, because all the money is coming from the city hall and from the mayor. So it's entirely different. But both in the States and here, I have to operate within a budget, of course, certainly. So I get to find out what the budget is, and then I adjust the season, the programs, the artists, so that I can make the most out of the money that we have.
Is this part, this aspect of the job, sometimes a bit, I don't know if the word boring is a good word, because from the beginning, it's supposed to be music, it's supposed to be art, something far away from like administration, asking for money, dealing with schedules, with all this very down-to-earth stuff. And we're supposed to talk about hearts with a big A.
But if you look at the history, go back to, for instance, the time of Bach or Haydn. They had patrons. Sometimes it was the church. Sometimes it was a prince in the castle. But they were fundraising too. It was no different. And for me, I believe that part of the job of running an orchestra or an arts institution does mean you have to go and find the money to support. We cannot be above this. It's the 21st century. We have to look around us. The world is in trouble. There's economic disasters all over the place. And we have to be sensitive to that. We have to find, we're in competition now with everything else. If you're, say in your 20s, 25 years old, 26, it's a Saturday night. Now you choose. Do you go to the concert? Do you stay at home and watch television? Do you go to a club? There's so many things for people to do. Or do you stay in your car and listen to the radio? Do you go on the internet and hear all the radio stations throughout the world? We have to work even harder now to get our audience and to educate the young people. And I think all that, the fundraising, the education, the building of the orchestra, this is all part of the job of the music director. Now, I know some people don't agree with that. They say, you're right, we just need to focus on the art. But I don't think we can anymore. I think we must be part of the society.
Is this a frustration that we can't anymore?
Not for me.
No?
No, it's just the way the world is. Mm. You can't be frustrated about what you cannot control.
Mm. Let's go back to Berlioz. You just mentioned it. There's also this... the release of the album on Nexus of Symphonie Fantastique. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your relationship with Berlioz in general, his music. Oh, his music came in your musical education and the relationship you had and you have with him and this particular piece.
I think for young musicians, especially conductors, the Fantastique is one of those very important works that you begin to study when you're beginning your career. Again, I had the advantage of working with a French teacher, so that we got to know this work from the inside out. We knew everything about it. I think what's interesting is that when you're young, you can't wait until you get to the fourth and the fifth movements, the scaffold and the witch's Sabbath. And it seems that the first half hour is not so interesting. And as you get older, it's actually the first three movements that become much more fascinating to you. At this point in my life, I must say that I find Berlioz not just a great composer or an innovator or creator, whatever you want to call it. His genius places him as one of the most original composers in the history of music. The Fantastique is written only a few years after Beethoven has died, and yet the world of this symphony could not be more far apart. The only connection to Beethoven is that it's in five movements, something very unusual for the time, and in Beethoven we have this example from the Sixth Symphony. But here's Berlioz. He's got this huge orchestra, but he only uses it in the last two movements. The first movement, there are no trombones. There's no percussion, just one timpani near the end. And the trumpets don't come in until near the end. So it's really almost a Mozart-sized orchestra for the first movement. And yet, the harmonic world and this idea of creating a story through his music, totally unique. Then you come to the second one. Here's the harps. For the recording, we used four harps, as Berlioz asks for. So it's somewhat unusual to do it, but we thought it was a nice idea. It's the only time the harps play in the whole piece. They play, and they finish. Then you come to the third movement, with this dialogue between the oboe and the cor anglais, placed far apart, like two shepherds talking to each other. And then the magnificent beginnings of the storm with the timpani and the English horn talking to each other. And then this love music that happens. It's musically a depiction of the most erotic moment you can imagine. If we were to make a movie of it, it would be rated X. That's what's in this music. Then finally, in the fourth movement, we're introduced to the rest of the percussion and the rest of the brass. And we have the march to the scaffold, a very scary kind of music. And the last one, with the Witch's Sabbath, with its use of the Dies Irae, with the bells off stage, and with all the unusual effects Berlioz puts. Berlioz to French music is probably a little bit like Charles Ives was to American music. Somebody in the orchestra, while we were rehearsing the Requiem, said, you know, Berlioz was ahead of Boulez in this idea of the spaces and these ideas, and it's true. Maybe for me, though, Berlioz is a little bit like a French Mahler with the use of the orchestra in ways that nobody had thought of before, and this long structures. The Fantastique is a remarkable piece, and you can never take it for granted. One other nice feature in the recording, maybe some people are not aware of it, Berlioz actually made a second version of the second movement, the Ball, which featured a trumpet solo, cornet really, probably written for the great virtuoso Arban. And we thought it would be nice for the listeners to have a choice of both movements to hear what Berlioz did a little bit later. Also on the disc is the Corsair Overture, another brilliant piece of music, very advanced for its time. And so I think that we're looking, maybe not at a Berlioz cycle, but several discs that we will do for Noxus featuring this composer's music. It's clearly in the blood of the orchestra, and I've grown up with it all my life, so I'm very honored to be able to commit some of this music to disc here.
You talk about some specific pieces you like to...
Romeo and Juliet in particular. Mm. It's a piece I've always felt close to. And this, again, strange idea of a symphony, just completely crazy, with the chorus and the three soloists and just unusual orchestra effects he's got going on. So that's one piece. Most likely Harold in Italy as well. I'm anxious to do that. Maybe Damnation. We'll see.
There are some other composers you Ravel
is coming out in November, the first disc of a series of Ravel recordings. The first one is mostly the popular pieces. Bolero is there, the Pavane is there, the Rhapsodie Espagnole, but also a couple of unusual pieces. There's a Habanera, originally a work for violin and piano, but there was an orchestration made, so we thought we would record that, keep the somewhat Spanish theme going. And then over the course of the next few years, we'll be recording and performing the two operas, some of the pieces that Ravel wrote that other people orchestrated, like the Gaspard de la Nuit, and other pieces that have never been recorded before. Early works for chorus and orchestra, working of a piece by Rimsky-Korsakov called Antar, that Ravel wrote incidental music for a play, so that's put together, we'll do that. And that should be a very exciting project. Again, it's music the orchestra knows very well, so it's a lot of fun for me to share my ideas with them, but also learn from the orchestra, from their tradition and history.
For you, who had a huge discography, whole albums were important for you, and what role do they play in your musical education when you were a little kid, even
when
if
I was
we know
a little
the story
boy,
that music was in your home from day one. So
I had no choice. There was my parents were part of a string quartet. They were part of the film music industry, the popular music industry. But in my room, I had a record player. Probably many of our listeners don't know what a record player is. Let's say this. In my day, to be a DJ meant you played the records, you didn't scratch them. You listened to them. And that was a window to the world. All of a sudden, you could hear Toscanini, Reiner, Manteau, Munch. They all came into your home from the recordings. And I would sit in my room.
Some of them came really to
you. Oh, many came. Yes, they did.
That's a problem.
That's true, true. That's true. Although not so many conductors, but Stravinsky came, Schoenberg came, Sinatra came all the time. It was very nice. I was just a little boy. Yeah. I remember some of it, though, so it's nice. So the recording industry was very important. So the question is, what does it mean today? life is changing. The LP doesn't exist much anymore.
But even for you, because, I mean, in all the interviews that we are doing with musicians, conductors, there's like a little bit of two sides. Some people who are always been very close to records in their musical education, mm-hmm. and some of them who try just to be next to the composers and
well,
the partition. And, that's
and then in between that is somebody like Glenn Gould,
yeah.
who decided yes. that he never wanted to see the public, yeah. that it would only be recording, because then he could put down on a disc exactly what he thought, because he doesn't speak about what happens if he has a new idea the next day. For me, a recording is a little bit like a photograph, in that you take the picture and it represents that moment in time. If you were to place the same person in the same place the next day, it might look entirely different. So for me, a recording is just a photograph of one thought on one day when you recorded it. I'm at the point now where I've recorded some pieces two and even three mm-hmm. times. So the question is, why? Why would I do them again? What was wrong the first time? Nothing was wrong. It's just, that's how I thought about it 15, 20 years ago. There's a recording now of the Second Symphony of Rachmaninoff, which I recorded 30 years ago in St. Louis. And then 2 years ago, I recorded it in Detroit. And the differences are incredible. The new one is about 5 minutes faster. But it's not a question of the tempo. It's a question of how I pace the structure. I think both recordings are good. I can't say that I prefer one over the other. It's just I've changed my mind about how I feel about the piece today. Here, I recorded Bolero many years ago, but that piece doesn't change. That's more about the soloists and the orchestra. And I've never recorded the Fantastique, even though I've performed it at least 100 times. And over the years, my feelings about that piece have changed too. Like I said at the beginning, it was all about the last two movements when I was young, and now that I'm older, it's about the first three. So, do I go back and listen to anybody else before I put a piece to the disc? No, I can't do that. Mm. I can only go by what I think. I think one other thing that's changed with me. Everything I do, I always ask myself one question. Why did I do it this way? For example, if I make a retard where it doesn't say so in the score, I can't just go, well, that's how I feel it should go. I have to have a reason to make this retard. Maybe something in the harmony wants me to take time and slow down. Maybe there's a melodic space that needs to happen. Maybe it's something with the dynamics. I don't know. But I must be able to answer that question. And I won't do anything on a disc until I can say something about every moment in a piece of music.
But like you said, I mean, it's a snapshot of you at a certain time.
Yeah.
And as every human being, there's like evolution and some change sometimes. So sometimes
sure.
the reason in 20 years ago is not the same reason
that's
today.
That's exactly right. In fact, you can do a performance one night and then you come back the next day and you, it's too slow. Mm. I'd like to do this faster or do something else. But now I have to ask myself, why? Why would I make those changes? Mm. So that makes it more interesting for me. It's more about the structure, the architecture of the piece of music now, not the details.
If we keep this comparison with like pictures, which are the 2, 3, 4 pictures which are on your desk? Like, you know, like family picture we have. Is there like some recordings that through the years...
Of mine or from other
people?
Of you. Well,
even if I'm sure you're not listening to them every day.
No, I hope not. That's too much ego.
There's a couple of
I'll tell you, if there's a recording I made in St. Louis of the Brahms First Serenade that I really love, as well as Schubert's Big C Major Symphony. I think that was a great recording. The Walton First Symphony that I did in London was a wonderful recording. The Ducas Symphony that I did in Paris, I think, is an outstanding recording. Again, I haven't heard these in years, so they were okay then. I don't know. There are a couple that I didn't like, but not many. I felt pretty good about most of them. There was a recording many years ago we did with the jazz artist Deodato. He made a big hit with Also Sprach Zarathustra, this jazz version. So they decided it would be a good idea for him to play with orchestra. No, it was a terrible idea. It was a horrible, horrible recording. I bought every copy and burned them.
Is like a train to shape sound. A sound is like the main goal when you start a story with an orchestra, in a way.
Yes, it is about the sound. These days, when you travel from one orchestra to the other, you don't have quite the distinction of the orchestra's personality and sound as it was, say, 30, 35 years ago. We used to talk about the Stokowski and Ormandy Philadelphia sound. We talked about the George Sells Cleveland sound, Reiner Chicago sound, so forth and so on. We don't really speak about that so much anymore. I think about the 1970s, things changed. Conductors started to think, well, it shouldn't sound like the orchestra. It needs to sound more like the composer. Okay, I understand that. But would we ask the great soloist to change that way? Do we ask Yo-Yo Ma to play Haydn differently than he plays Beethoven? In other words, should he always sound like Yo-Yo Ma? And the answer is yes, of course he should. And I think the same is true for an orchestra. Years ago, I conducted the Czech Philharmonic. We did Sacre du Printemps. And after the first rehearsal, a few of the brass section members came to see me and they said, "We know, Mr. Slatkin, that you're conducting in Chicago quite often. How can we sound more like the Chicago brass? We love that sound." And I said, "You know, I came here to conduct the Czech Philharmonic. If I wanted to have Lysak sounding like Chicago Symphony, I would conduct it in Chicago. I want to hear your sound. I like the individuality that you bring to it." So I get a little concerned in our time that we're losing, I don't want to say the national sonority, maybe a little bit, but more the individuality. What makes one orchestra different than the other in its totality?
Where is the origin of that? Why do you think it's changed like that?
I think in the 1970s, at least in the United States, what happened is all of a sudden we had many Austro-Germanic or Austro-Germanic trained conductors. And the orchestras all started to have the same repertoire. So whether it was New York or Cleveland or Chicago, everybody was playing Bruckner, Strauss, Mahler, and all of the special repertoires seemed to disappear. Only in places like Montreal, where Dutoit was doing an incredible job with the French repertoire, in St. Louis, I think, where we did a lot of Russian and American music, we somehow kept a personality to this by the repertoire we played. But it became more difficult to tell Boston from New York, New York from Cleveland. They all started to sound a little bit too similar because they were all playing the same music. I remember one time in New York, in 1 week, three different orchestras played Bruckner No. 4. Why? I mean, certainly were all wonderful performances, but I like orchestras because of why they're different, not because of why they're the same.
Do you think that orchestra and nationalities are something which are completely different? I mean, it's interesting, when you were working in the U.S., almost all the main musical director were non-American.
Well, that's always been the case.
That's
you know, in fact, the American repertoire of what we call the classic Americans, like Copland or even Gershwin, Barber, all this music was introduced by conductors who were not American. It would have been Koussevitzky, Stokowski, Ormandy, Reiner. All these people actually gave the premieres of the American repertoire. And the orchestras themselves, in the early days, were mostly people coming from other countries. In Boston, there was a great Italian population in the orchestra, as it was in New York. Then in other orchestras, it was French. Other orchestras had more Germanic people in the orchestra, different kind of training. So our national music in the States really was international when we started. Now, of course, we have musicians coming from all over the world. So many people coming now from China and from Japan and Korea. Now it's starting, of course, Venezuela as well and other South American cities. My only hope is that we find, maybe the best way to tell you this is that in Detroit, my current orchestra, when we audition for positions, I don't really think about the technique of the musicians. I think about their sound and what sound will be the best one to match the other players in the orchestra. How can we keep them unique? I don't want what we call cookie cutter. It means I don't want musicians who just play the notes. I want musicians who play inside the notes and bring something special. I want to be able to sit up and listen to everything they do.
What souvenir do you keep from, you mentioned the Hollywood String Quartet, quatuor of your parents, who was amazing at his time because they were playing classical music, sometimes not so popular, like Schoenberg, Frank Lartenhardt, and till Frank Sinatra, like we know. So, like you said, I was a kid, you say.
Yeah.
But, I mean, does that mean that stuff happened around you and you didn't realize that much?
No, because it was every day. That was my life.
Yeah, and they were your parents, so.
Well, yeah, it was my parents, and when these other people would come over, you know, oh, Leonard, I'd like you to meet Mr. Stravinsky. And, oh, how do you do? Nice to meet you. Even Sinatra, who was very close to our family, you know, he was Uncle Frank. When I was very little, he would take me by the hand, walk me upstairs, and sing me the lullabies to go to sleep. It's pretty amazing.
Could have been worse.
It could have been worse, and I wish I had one of these machines that you're taping me on back then, but I was only, you know, 5 years old or six. So whether it was Nat King Cole or Danny Kaye or the great film composers, Korngold, Max Steiner, Dmitri Tiomkin, Miklos Rocha, that was just the way it was when I grew up. Only when I got older did I begin to realize what it really was. And when I wrote my book, and I write about this period, of course, I really realized how special it was. But at the time, it didn't seem that unusual.
But I think it was mainly special because of how it opened your mind.
Oh,
I mean, that's a key element, I think.
The key element really was a little bit of what Duke Ellington said when he was asked, what do you think about different kinds of music? And Ellington said, you know, there
only two kinds of music. There's good music and the other stuff. And I think, of course, he's right. For me, I really don't categorize music. I just think of it as either good or not so good. I have a son who's just starting college this week, so he's 18 years old, and through his life, I've listened to the music of his colleagues in school. So I lived through Linkin Park, I lived through Coldplay, I lived through certain heavy metal, I lived through some rap, I lived through this, I lived through that, and I never judged it. I just said, yeah, that's good. It's not good like in the same way that the Beatles were good or the Rolling Stones were good, but it's a different kind of good. I understood, and I listened to what he had to listen to, and I think he respected me because I took the time to listen to his music. If I had one word of advice for all parents, listen to your children's music. Don't say that's terrible. Listen to it. Try to understand what makes it so interesting for them. Maybe part of it is to be rebellion. And maybe they don't want your parents listening to it, maybe. But it still, it helps if you to understand your children if you know what they're listening to.
Close to you, I will always stay. Close to you, though you're far away. You'll always be near as though you were here by my side. No matter where in my dreams I'll find you there close to me. Sharing your caress, can't you see? You're my happiness. Wherever you go, what can I do? It only wants to be close to you. What can I do? It only wants to be close to you.
What kind of listener are you today in 2012? I mean, are you a bit blasé or sometimes you're like completely shaken by some
I go primarily, I go by, I get these listening moments primarily in jazz. I don't really listen so much to what we call classical music, not really. But I listen to a lot of jazz, and I usually go through a phase. All of a sudden I say, okay, I want to hear everything Oscar Peterson did, everything, which is a lot.
Yeah,
and I listen to a lot of it. A few weeks ago I went back and re-listened to an incredible group called the Singers Unlimited. I don't know if you know them, but you should. This was an amazing group. Never performed in concert. They couldn't. They could only make records because of what they did. I just realized this is just... I'm going to try to actually orchestrate some of the things they did because it's interesting. Or I get now also into Latin jazz. I have a very good friend who came here and played last season, named Michel Camilo. Phenomenal pianist. He's introduced me to wonderful artists in person, like Chucho Valdez and Gonzalo Rubalcaba, and just so many others. So I go through these listening phases, just different kinds of things in my life. But I really don't listen so much to the classical music unless I'm listening to older artists. I've been also going through a phase of not only listening but watching Glenn Gould. He made many television programs, about 20 hours, and it's fascinating to see what he had to say. Incredible intellect. Maybe too much intellect, maybe. Because sometimes what he says is a little bit more than you need to know about the music. But to hear him talk and then perform and see the direction he's going with his performance is absolutely fascinating.
Is there some repertoire that where you haven't dig in it that much that you'd like to? Or maybe some composers or repertoire you rediscovered recently were not that important for you in the past, and now you realize that actually...
Well, there are some composers that I simply don't do. And I keep thinking, okay, one day I will have an epiphany, a revelation, and all of a sudden it will be good. Bruckner is one of them. I don't do very much Baroque music. That I understand. It was easy when I was younger. Now there's too many rules. It's so far away from the Baroque music that I heard when I was young that it's too hard for me to make that adjustment. Bruckner just never touched me. It never got inside me. And every time I try to do one, I say, okay, that's it. I'm not doing it again. It just doesn't work. But maybe I'll try. I have been fascinated with some music that my teacher, Morel, brought to my attention, of course, a long time ago. And that's music by the French composers who were the contemporaries of Ravel and Debussy, who were pretty much not played anywhere anymore. So they could be Pianet, Roger Ducasse, Ducas in some cases, of course, Caplet, and so many others, who really are wonderful composers, and that I'll begin to revive here in Lyon.
You are to be a conductor today, and a conductor like you is like traveling a lot, playing a lot, having a crazy schedule. It's a small word, but do you sometimes, with so much music, want you like to push the pause button sometimes?
I've just started doing that. As we are talking, I've finished 5 weeks of vacation, something I've never done before, and I thought this was a very good idea. Because I came back fresh.
Yeah, even for creativity, not just to rest,
And I didn't study, I didn't do anything. I just stayed at home, I watched sports.
The Cardinals?
Cardinals and now Detroit Tigers, yes, okay. Thank you. I went to lots of movies with my son. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen cooking. I love to cook. And I think now it's more important for me to take more time off. One reason that I accepted the job in Lyon was even though it looks like the travel is difficult, it's actually easier. In the past, I would have my orchestra in the States, and then I would travel every week to a different city. Now, I'll come to Lyon, say, for 2 weeks, sometimes three. And I have a flat here. So I don't really have to travel quite as much. I can come for 2 and 3 weeks sitting in one city instead of one city every week. So for me, that's already a lot better. And I think over the next few years now, I'll begin to not do quite so much, even in the main season. I'm very happy with my orchestra in Detroit and here, and maybe just a little guest conducting, but not too much.
Thank you, Lena Slatkin, and good luck for the second season in Lyon.
Thank you very much. I hope to talk to you in the third, fourth, and fifth.
Rencontre par Marc Zisman.